But okay, so this is a review for our test number 3, and which includes chapter 8 through 12, plus whatever we get to on 13. And right now I'm looking at chapter 8, overhead number 2. And as you recall, I asked you to be able to identify these carbohydrates that are in the boxes that are listed there on overhead number 2. That's glyceraldehyde, ribose, glucose, mannose, and galactose. When I ask you to do that, I want you to do that in both the Fischer form that you see here, that's the straight chain form, and also the cyclic form. So I want you to be able to identify the cyclic form of each of these. There will not be a cyclic form, of course, for glyceraldehyde, but there will be for ribose, glucose, mannose, and galactose. If you recall, I said when you move from the Fischer form here into the Hayworth projection, which is the cyclic form of it, and the cyclic form always has the alcohol on the upper right-hand corner of the cyclic structure, or the top oxygen of the cyclic structure that's got five carbons in it, or five molecules, five atoms in this ring, that the right here, right is down. Right is down. So carbon number 2 is down, carbon number 3 is up, carbon number 2 is down, number 3 is down, and number 4 is down on glucose. Yeah, I think that's it. So right is down, if I recall my thing. So then we also need to look at, yes, down, up, down, down. Yep. Except number 5 doesn't exist, so it's down, up, down. There's only 3 that exist. All right, so then on the overhead number 3, you've got the definition of what carbohydrate is. You've got the idea of the number of stereocenters, the idea that epimers are different by only one position in their stereochemistry, differentialized cyclized forms, 6-member ring name, 5-member ring name, and anomeric is carbon number 1. You must not forget that. You must also know on overhead number 3 the boxed structures for the ketoses, dideoxyacetone, deribulose, and fructose. Especially, I'm not so concerned about the cyclic structure of ribulose or dehydroxyacetone, but defructose as a structure, in a cyclic structure you're going to need to know. For example, if there are questions about that, I will ask you in terms of a matching. There will be no surprises. There'll be no sorbose or tagalose or xylose here on this. Here you see some of the modifications: aldonic acids, uronic acids, aldetols, and they have specific positions that are either oxidized or reduced. I may give you, like galactonic acid or galacturonic acid. You need to tell me which is which. In other words, that, of course, aldonic is the oxidation of the aldehyde, uronic oxidation of the ultimate alcohol. Aldetols are reductions of the aldehydes and ketones. You have the deoxy sugars, which are familiar from DNA, the amino sugars, which, of course, are named. You will not be required to memorize these structures here. I would expect that you would know 2-deoxyribose, but fucose, glucosamine, galactosamine, you will not be required to know specifically. Nor will you need to know the specific ribitol, xylitol names, or myo-inositol structure. But again, I'm going to ask you, what classification would you call this? Aldonic, uronic, or an aldetol? And you'll have to tell me that. So you'll have to classify these carbohydrates pretty accurately. All right. So the polysaccharides. Oligosaccharides means more than one. They're both linear and branched. The disaccharides, you need to be able to identify by matching sucrose, lactose, and of course the one thing that was dropped here, what's this one? And you need to be able to identify cellulose, a two-sugar structure of cellulose. You need to tell me the difference in chemistry between Tollens test and Benedict's test. You need to be able to tell me what reducing sugars are and why sucrose is not a reducing sugar. Why is sucrose not a reducing sugar? And why does glycogen or starch have only one reducing end, but it has many, many non-reducing ends? Does that make sense?
Could you explain that to us? I mean,
you want me to explain it to you?
Yeah.
You want me to teach? Oh, I don't know. I suppose, yes, I guess if you're going to force me to. Of course, I'm being silly. It's very straightforward. It's, yes, she's exactly right. It's because of the, what did you say?
Branching.
Okay, the branching. And the branching is unique in the fact that the branches are all connected through the anomeric carbon. That's this carbon number one. It's always a 1-6 linkage, or in this case, a 1-4 linkage. And once that number one carbon here or here or here or here or here or here, I'm looking at overhead number 7 on chapter 8. Once that is covalently bound to another structure, that becomes locked in that position and therefore cannot open up to form the aldehyde required to reduce the metal ion. So here you see at the end of this short segment of glycogen or starch, there is one reducing end. Whereas with given the branching, there are many, many, many non-reducing ends. So it has to do with how the sugars are connected and the fact that the non-reducing ends are created by many number one carbons connecting to number fours or number sixes. Whereas there is only one, at the beginning here, one reducing end that's available to open up from the ring structure. Remember, I said had this silly ring structure like this and opened up small amount of it, less than 5%, less than 1% in any solution is the open chain form. But that's enough to reduce copper and silver. Is that helpful? Okay, just as a quick reminder, exactly. All right, so what's the difference between a Benedict's test and a Tollens test? How can you tell a positive Benedict's test? What is the color indicator for a positive rust red? And what is the positive indicator for a Tollens test? Silver. All right, exactly right. Okay, and here you see, of course, what is the difference between starch and glycogen? Of course, starch is the what? Plant form of carbohydrate storage. It contains branches. The unbranched form is amylose. The branched form is amylopectin. And you can see the different kinds of branches and so on there. I'm not going to belabor the point. That's pretty easy. Overhead number 8. Here we get into a more complex structure. Proteoglycans, you need to be able to understand the definition of proteoglycans. You also need to understand the definition of glycosaminoglycans. Glycosaminoglycans are polysaccharides that contain repeating disaccharide units. If you see on overhead number 8, I believe I asked you to recall the repeating disaccharide units in a matching form. I believe what I have said before, and I think I'm actually repeating myself because I just want to make sure I said it before, that I would ask you to know these things in terms of matching. Okay? I believe I said that. It is because so there is a lot of interesting chemistry going on in medicine and in nutrition dealing with these complex carbohydrates. There are individuals who are selling these complex carbohydrates as nutritional supplements for joint pain. And while you will, of course, be given a much more intensive understanding of how their behavior exists in medical school, in vet school, perhaps a little bit in dental school and graduate school, depending on where you go, having of that fundamental knowledge of their structure will assist you in understanding why they behave the way they do in a, as a molecule. Let me just look at it. Notice, if you would, the proteoglycans are found in synovial fluid, vitreous humor, arterial walls, because they are so hydrophobic. Lots and lots of polar oxygens, lots and lots of polar carboxylic acid groups and amino groups and amide groups. These are heavily hydrated by water. They're surrounded by water, water, water. It's one of the reasons why, while even though you are made up of 75% water, as remember my humorous anecdote, this is why you don't slosh, because all the water is bound up in waters of hydration. Every bit, every molecule of water has some purpose, and much of it is bound up here. My eyeballs are, in fact, drying out a little bit. The vitreous in my eyeballs are drying out a little bit as I get older, and I have a crack in one of my eyes, one of the vitreous humor. And when I go from looking in a dark, darkened room to an outside view or looking at very bright, I can see a shadow in my eye that comes from the dried out vitreous humor that the light is bending around. So it has very real meaning to you and to me about this material, that if it's not fully hydrated, it does have direct patient behavior. Anyway, so you need to know that. You just need to know that. I don't know what to tell you. Structures to the names. I'm not going to ask you to regurgitate the names. There are subtle differences between these. I understand that. And you should perhaps just underline, look as you write this down on a set of six cards with the name on the other side, and circle the differences that are unique for each of them, and you should be able to identify them very quickly. I'm going to cut and paste directly out of this. It's not going to be very fancy. I'm not going to try to trick you. But I do expect you to know it, because I do expect you to be able to go to medical school, dental school, and have a foundation that means something. All right. Again, we're going to look at additions. The details here are important. What they're used for, the hyaluronic acids. It's interesting, if you recall, these five here are all connected to a backbone, some of which are proteins, but the heparin is independent. It's not connected to any protein. You'll figure that out. The hyaluronic acid is, not attached to protein and found in synovial fluid. It's also active. That dermatan sulfate, some of these, and the heparin and so on. You have to understand how much detail they want you to know. I mean, pretty much you need to know this entire page, overhead number 9, be able to discuss that in, not discuss it, but probably answer a multiple choice question about it. Yes?
Well, I was just a little bit confused by the
hyaluronic acid.
Right, and then it says it's not completely attached
to the protein, but I guess when I interpret the diagram that's on the right,
it seems to me like it is. Like the core proteins on the side are completely attached to it.
Yeah, in other words, it's a matter of semantics. The hyaluronic acid is the backbone that proteins attach to. So that's when I say not a covalently attached to protein. In other words, that it's a kind of like a priority thing, that the hyaluronic acid is the backbone and is the foundation for whatever structure there is. And so you have the hyaluronic acid, you have the single segment of protein, then you have a core backbone, and then you've got carbohydrate on the back of it. So even though there's a protein linker right there, the way I have it said, not covalently attached to protein, I'm trying to say that it's not like this, the hyaluronic acid is attached to a protein backbone, that the hyaluronic acid is independent, and there are protein linkers attached to the hyaluronic acid.
Okay.
I know that. Literally, there is some protein attached to the hyaluronic acid. You're correct. You are absolutely right. Yep. Perhaps, how would I change that to a protein backbone? Would that be more helpful if I would say it that way? Let me just go ahead and put that in there then. Back to not sulfate, not completely attached to protein backbone. However, protein linkers, and I'm going to put that in parentheses just so that protein linkers are bound to it. Are bound to it. Okay. There we go. All right. Okay, well, anyway, we will, you need to know that. Let's see here. That's pretty simple, why proteoglycans are where they are. Next slide talks about the overall fate of this. I will not be asking you to diagram this fate. If there's going to be any questions, it'll probably be questions probably about a multiple choice question dealing with the information listed on overhead number 10 about synthesis degradation of glycosaminoglycans. I'm not going to ask you to regurgitate overhead number 11. Number 12, the glycoproteins. I'm not going to ask you to identify the amino acid derivative mannose or fucose or nana or whatever. I'm primarily looking at the big picture here. The big picture is that, of course, there are two forms of glycoproteins, N-linked and O-linked, and two methods of synthesis. There is the method of synthesis between O-linked and N-linked are distinctly different, and I want you to be able to distinguish between the two kinds. You need to... Yes?
I was just going to ask about the
UPD?
Yes.
UDP sugars? Mm-hmm. Oh, uridine diphosphate. What that means is, to expand on what UDP sugars are, and it's an excellent question, thank you for asking. UDP sugars are, let me put this in here right now, high energy, high-energy precursors. And because they're high-energy precursors, they allow the synthesis to occur. In other words, they're like sugars whose pumps have been primed, and they're ready to attach to a longer growing chain because they bring the energy necessary to do the attachment with them in the form of UDP. Uridine diphosphate. You'll see this again at a later time. The only thing I want you to know out of that is that UDP sugars are these high energy intermediates, and the actual number, the name of the sugar and what the sugar is irrelevant at this point. I gave you a list, but you do not need to memorize the list. What's the difference between O-linked and N-linked glycoproteins? It's attachment. What amino acids are the O-linked attached to? And what about N-linked? There's only one. What is it? Asparagine. N-linked, synthesized on what? What's it say here? Dolichyl phosphate. You can see the purpose of the glycoproteins, what they're used for. We're going to go ahead, doink. Please. There are a variety of reasons. The primary reason why carbohydrates face the exterior is it provides another level of information to distinguish self from non-self. Provides another level of information. You can have a protein sticking out there, but you can also have a specific kind of carbohydrate sticking out from that. And so it's a combination of the protein, its structure, and the carbohydrate in its structure that allows for recognition.
And so is it ever found facing the interior?
You know, I would love to say never, but as a biochemist, I've learned not to. No, 99.9% of the time, if they ask you where you're going to find that kind of carbohydrate structure, it's always going to be on the exterior.
Okay.
They will, if they're going to give you something else, they will try to write a question that gives you that big fat hint that it's there. All right. You need to be able to explain how N-linked glycoproteins are synthesized. Overhead number 13 is a favorite questioning area of mine. You will not need to regurgitate the diagram, but you might need to discuss the order of which things occur and perhaps write a caption about that diagram, for example. If I blank out certain pieces of information, again, the test is not long enough for me to test everything. So even all the stuff I've discussed, there will be questions that are not going to be on the test. And for that, I apologize. But I would have to apologize to the dean if he gave you a six-hour test. Come in at 4 a.m. and we'll just start. And okay, enough of that. The eye cell disease, simply, there should probably be a multiple-choice question about it. Again, I'm not going to ask you to memorize the diagram there. Read through that. Be aware of it. A detailed explanation probably is not going to be required. And I'm certainly not going to ask you about the disease symptoms and so on. It's a deadly disease. It's a genetic disease. But you need to know what it is. Can't phosphorylate mannose of the N-linked glycoprotein. Therefore, it builds up. Unhydrolyzed substrates accumulate in the lysosome. All right, we're done with 8. Let's go on to number 9. What's going to happen is I'll probably emphasize the ones that are older, and the ones that are relatively new, we won't go over quite as much detail. These thoughts for the day are very important. I'm going to ask many detailed questions about them. I'm just teasing about that. No, not at all. Oh, fats. It's almost fats. Do fats have a taste? Do fats have a taste? Can you taste a fat? Have you ever taken a dollop of shortening and put it on your tongue and goes, oh, that tastes so good? Do you ever do that? No. But it does provide important sensations in your digestive tract that are related to satiation. Do you feel full? You do feel full when you eat fat. All right, what's the definition of lipid? You see it right there. Okay. Are there any odd chain fatty acids that you synthesize? No. Where do you find odd chain fatty acids? You find them in plants. Plants are the only place where you find odd chain fatty acids. They're almost always found as esters and seldom as free fatty acids. Acids, it's not, there's a reason why they're not found as a free fatty acid. Acids, as you know, are tart. Tart. And certain fatty acids are so tart that they're not even pleasant. Free fatty acids have an unpleasant texture and taste. So when you're eating fats, you're never eating just fatty acids. You're always eating the ester, the triacylglycerol, or the triglyceride. What's the difference between fat and oils? What's the difference? What is, are fats components of membranes? What does it say there? Are fats components of membrane? No, they're not. They're not. Not as fats. What is a fat? What's the backbone for a fat? Glycerol, CH3, CH2. CHO, CH2O. And to that, you add three fatty acids. Well, when you make them, make an ester out of them, they lose their chemical tartness. They lose their acidity. And they become very, very nonpolar. Very water-hating. There's no water-loving area in this. If there is a little oxygen right here, but it hardly makes up for the 18, 16, 14, 12 carbons here, here, and here. So this whole thing is an oily mess. If it's 16 carbons or greater or whatever, and they're all saturated, you got Crisco right there. You know how that feels on your skin and stuff. All right. That's enough of that. I think I talked about this just very quickly. What's the energy content of carbohydrates in calories per gram, food calories per gram? Carbohydrate is what? Four. Proteins are four. Proteins are four. Fats are nine. I cannot tell you how important that is to remember it. I'm not going to probably ask a question about it. But if you forget it, because I'm not going to ask a question about it on this test, I'm going to be mad at you. Okay? Four, four, and nine. You will not believe it when you get out of graduate school how often people are going to ask you about that. No, seriously, because they're all overweight and they're all trying to lose weight. And my friend said if I ate 10,000 calories of just fat, then I'm going to lose weight. Well, yes. Primarily because you're going to be malnourished. You're going to lose a few pounds initially because you will not have any carbohydrate in your body. Okay, enough of that. You need to know the number of carbons in the following common names. And did I give you a list earlier? Do you have a checkmark list earlier? Could you tell me what that checkmark list was? Okay, hold it. We'll do a human microphone. Like they do on... Okay. First list, what word was what?
Lauric acid.
Lauric acid. Next one was?
Palmitic.
Next one was?
Stearic.
And that's it? Oh, good night. How cheesy. How cheap. Oh, my goodness. I'm so easy on you guys. But you do need to be aware of the other 18s. There are four other 18s, three of which I care about. The first one, oleic acid, the next is linoleic, and the next one is alpha-linolenic. Maybe gamma-linolenic, but I don't either. The first three are the most important. Why do I care about oleic, linoleic, and linolenic acid as opposed, compare and contrast that with stearic? Right. Right. Now, what is this? This is a Sesame Street question. What is the same about stearic, oleic, and linolenic? Number of carbons. They all have what? What's different about them? Bonds. Okay? Bonds. Which one has double bonds? It's not just which one, it's what? Which ones? Which ones of those four have double bonds? Oleic, linoleic, and linolenic. Does stearic have a double bond in it? No. Okay. Let me ask you this question. When I melt oleic acid, am I breaking a double bond? Oh, thank you for saying no. I can't tell you how hard it is to tell introduction to chemistry people what melting is. They all think it's a breaking of a bond. But it's not, is it? It's overcoming intermolecular forces, which are not bonds. Except, of course, for that one horribly confusing bond known as the hydrogen bond, which we know, in fact, should not be called a hydrogen bond. It's just simply confusing. Compare and contrast structure with melting point and boiling point. Actually, not. There's not a boiling point. Compare and contrast structure with melting point and explain why. Okay, overhead number four on chapter 9. I need for you to be able to take a phospholipid and break it apart if I give you the following phospholipases. A1, A2, C, and D. You need to be able to tell me where they break the phospholipid. Where they break the phospholipid. This is on the top left, right-hand corner of overhead number 4. Overhead number 4 should have a little diagram there. What's the difference between a glycerol 3-phosphate and a glycerol phospho... Well, never mind. Glycerol phospholipid there. You see that? How many tails are there on a glycerol phospholipid? How many fatty acid tails? 2. How many phosphates? 1. How many head groups? 1. If the head group is ethanolamine, the name is phosphatidylethanolamine. If it's choline, it's called what? Phosphatidylcholine. What is its other name? Nope. Close. Lecithin. 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 Sphingomyelin is another backbone. So, that's right. So, phosphatidyls all have what 3-carbon unit as a backbone? Glycerol or glycerin. By the way, glycerol, glycerin, the same molecule. Glycerol, glycerin is the same molecule. Notice here as well, if I would substitute one of the ester bonds with a double bonded oxygen linkage, this backbone or series, this lipid is then called a what? Say plasmologen. Plasmologen. What's the compare and contrast that with a glycerol phospholipid? It's got the head group. It's got the phosphate. It's got the 3-carbon backbone. It's got one ester to a fatty acid, but the other linkage to a hydrocarbon chain is through an oxygen double bond, an ether, etherine or whatever you want to call it. All right, plasmologen. Okay, sphingolipids. The base molecule of sphingolipid is called sphingosine. If you add one fatty acid through the nitrogen, it's going to be called a what? Ceramide. If I gave you this diagram, could you circle and without any labels? If I gave you this diagram without any labels, could you identify the sphingosine? If I gave it to you without any labels, could you identify the ceramide? What would be the ceramide? Yeah. Okay, I'm going to start in this corner. Tell me where I should move to circle the ceramide. Left. Tell me to stop. Okay, now what? Down. Right. Back up. That's a ceramide. What's the difference between a sphingosine and a ceramide? That fatty acid connected to a what? Nitrogen. That's an amide linkage, ladies and gentlemen, not an ester linkage. Is that why we studied a whole year of organic chemistry? You betcha, by golly, wow. You betcha. Mm-hmm. Okay, now then, am I going to ask you to what a GM1, GM2, and a GM3 is? No. In terms of the specific carbohydrates? No, I'm not. You just need to know what a ganglioside is. It's a ceramide that's got sugars on it. And there's a lot of important chemistry with it. Lots of diseases like the Tay-Sachs disease. I want you to be able, one ABC list of it. I want you to be able to tell me what enzyme is gone bad with Tay-Sachs and what the symptoms are of it. So circle Tay-Sachs and circle that name of the enzyme that's bad, genetically bad. Can you read it? You might have to blow it up on your page. It's called hexosaminidase A, in this case it's called beta hexosaminidase. Hexosaminidase A. Look at all that. Look at all the diseases that come from that region right there. Oh my goodness. All these diseases. Now then, imagine, it's very easy to understand why when you get done with medical school, unless you go to Loma Linda, why you can look at a patient as simply a bag of diseases. Why you want to go to Loma Linda, because you want to be able to look at a human being as a human being. Steroids. Anybody have a favorite steroid? Anybody here? Vitamin D, excellent. That's a very good steroid to have. Exactly. What's another test steroid that... What steroid are you glad men have? What steroid do we men, women have? What? What steroid are we glad we... What? How can I say this? What steroid are men glad that women have? Estrogen. What did I say before? I have to go through here and edit it out. You'll know. Estrogen, exactly right. Thank you, God, for those two hormones. Okay, the fundamental structure of the steroid, of course, is the four-ring structure. Oddly enough, I don't have cholesterol listed here, but so you need to know the purposes of each of these. You're going to go through, if you may have already done it in Systems Phys, did you go through all the glucocorticoids and the mineral corticoids and all their purposes and stuff? Have you gone through that in detail? Yeah, so I'm not going to belabor it. I don't have time to belabor it. So for those of you not in Systems Phys, you're not going to be anything behind. Just know overhead number 8 pretty well. There are no structures on overhead number 8 you need to memorize other than being able to identify the steroid backbone. This chapter 9, the derivatives of arachidonic acid, I want you to tell me, probably in a multiple choice question, what PGF2 alpha does and TXA2 does. Don't worry about TXB2. It doesn't have any function. And tell me what aspirin inhibits. What enzyme aspirin inhibits? Don't be able to tell me that. What does it inhibit? What's it say it inhibits? PGH2 synthase. PGH2 synthase is what aspirin inhibits. Yeah. Yeah, just do the first one and the last one here. Don't worry about TBX. There's nothing to know. Just PGF2 alpha and TX alpha 2, what it does. All right? And TBX. All right. Do you guys, don't mean to digress, but were you around on Sabbath when you heard that massive lightning strike?
Yes.
Do you know where it hit next to? Do you know Charles Neumann and you've been to their house? They live just off Tudor. If you want to see something truly amazing and take your camera, go to their house. Go to their house and you will be amazed. There is this tree, this massive tree that's completely blown apart, splintered apart by this lightning strike that hit it. Oh, I don't remember what their address is on Tudor. Just yeah, as you come from, you know where Tudor is. As there's a big curve on Tudor that if you went straight, you'd drive right into the right in. No, oh, it's on Snow Road and right by the Don's Automotive. You make a left and you go down there. At any rate, you need to go before they take it down. It hit their well. And sent voltage through their house, and they have every electrical system in their house is completely burned out. They're going to have to replace their refrigerator, freezer, even if it wasn't even on. If someone had been taking a shower that instant, they would have been killed because it went through their well. You can see their well casing right by the base of the tree. It's not their tree, but it got hit. And you can see where the voltage went right through the earth because it's all blown up and hit that well, blew the top casing apart, followed the electricity into their house, and they have no power and will not have power for weeks. No, they were coming back from church. It was within a half an hour. If somebody had been standing next to an electrical outlet and that thing hit, they would have been killed. It was just amazing. Got to go see it. Take your camera. Okay, now, what did I say about this overhead? Yeah, because I'm gonna give this to you. If I give this to you, what am I gonna do? I'm going to block out some of the labels. Not the boxed labels up here. Not this up here. That's ridiculous. Not this. But at these labels down here, triacylglycerides. What are these components actually made up of? All right? Those plasmologens, like they call it a glycero-ether. That's kind of a thing. So sphingosine, anyway, you'll get the idea. All right, that's that. Chapter 9, bilayers. Very low content on this overhead. You might want to, why is transverse diffusion flip-flop very slow compared to lateral diffusion? Because the head group has to go through that nonpolar interior and doesn't like to do it. There are flip aces. Membrane fluidity. Are there two phases in membrane fluidity? What is the temperature that occurs at that transition? What's that called? What's its abbreviation? TM. TM for transition temperature. Above it, you have life. Below it, you have death. Okay, membrane proteins. You can see there's intrinsic, which penetrate through the bilayer. One of the distinguishing characteristics of this, of course, is that the amino acids penetrating through the bilayer commonly have lots of nonpolar side chains. You can identify here the outside because of the carbohydrate groups sprinkling the interior, sprinkling the exterior. Very few, if any, on the interior. Transmembrane proteins, again, fluid mosaic model. How do you know there are two experiments we talked about to confirm the fluid mosaic model. One is called cell fusion, it's called FRAP, fluorescence recovery. After photo bleaching, I think that's what that means, FRAP, fluorescence recovery after photo bleaching. That's these two. So you need to be able to explain what these two are. How do they confirm the fluid mosaic model? Membrane skeleton, there's not a lot here. Some standardized tests really emphasize this. But probably I know that the standardized tests won't. We just don't have time. You need to be able to tell me. Don't tell me anything about this page except what's written there. Don't worry about the structure. Okay, now then, what does this diagram say about lipid bilayers? Is the composition of the lipid bilayer the same on each leaflet? No. What did I ask you to know about this? I would probably block out the captions here and put them in order. Have you put them in order? All right? So what I'll probably do is block out the labels, and have you write a caption. I love doing that, although, my goodness, it just takes forever to read this stuff. But I know, you're really very sympathetic to me and how much time it takes me to grade this. You shouldn't be. Okay, so transport within the membrane, within the cell. Of course, we know, define the different retrogrades and so on. Tell me what coated vesicles are coated with. Talk a little bit about clathrin-coated vesicles and how that operates a little bit. Again, some very quick definitions, Q-snares, R-snares, some taxins, synaptobrevins. These are all part of the process where membranes bind to each other and then fuse and open up and to form a single membrane, eptosynapses, this kind of thing. You can ignore that. That's number 9. Then we go through, hold on here. Number 10. A lot to know, isn't there? Although it's getting a little less. What?
Oh, I'm just missing a definition.
You're missing a what? A blank on what page? It was on 9?
Oh, yeah, 9.
Slide 19 on 9.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. All right. I have no idea why that is dotted right there. 10. You guys having to take off? Oh, that's right. You've got that meeting. Others will help you, I trust. Okay. Concentration gradient. You will not have any you will not have any calculations dealing with this concentration gradient. I do want you to know that, of course, the electromotive force that causes ions and other particles to move between the two outside and inside of the cells is all due to both concentration gradient and charge gradient. And that's why when you look at this equation right here, it has a concentration factor and also a voltage factor. So that's why they call it electrochemical gradient. Different kinds of transports, be able to identify those and answer questions in multiple choice form about the different styles that they exist. We fill this in, how to identify saturated enzyme, how inactivation by heat works, this kind of a thing. Different kinds of ionophores, channel. There's carrier and channel forming and how you can identify the differences and why temperature dependency is important on that. Overhead number 11. This is basically the action potential. You've seen this since high school. You will probably be asked questions about this, either a short answer or multiple choice. You can see here the other kinds of gated channels, mechanosensitive, ligand, signal, and voltage. Of course, voltage-gated channels are what you see right here. Explain to me why sodium permeability opens up and then potassium and how that's related to the action potential, the resting potential, hyperpolarization, and depolarization. Very straightforward, I think. Active transport, different types of pumps here, different names over here, symport, uniport, antiport, P-type, F-type, V-type, A-type, ABC transporter, again, most likely multiple choice question. Model for the ATPase. I believe I said I was going to include this on the test, didn't I? I don't think I... Did I say anything specific about it? Please don't make us know more stuff, Dr. Novak. Please, I want less value for my tuition dollar, not more. I think the model for this that you see right here is... I know it's beyond the scope of we have time to test. It's interesting to note, however, that there's a calcium pump in the heart that is ATP dependent, and that a lot of medicines attack that calcium pump and cause the calcium levels in the muscle tissue in the heart to be higher. And when that happens, it increases the strength of the pump, you know, heart action. Right. Okay. What? Oh. The three lines here. Don't memorize the diagram. Okay. And then active transport ion gradients. This is an interesting one. This is an antiport. This is a symport in which hydrogen and lactose are brought in simultaneously. That's the only piece of information you need to know that. Will I have to regurgitate that model? No, you will not. Interesting idea here. This diagram is full of cell biology, but we're going to focus on the biochemistry of this, and that is it's an interesting system here of both a symport, a uniport, and an antiport that's necessary to bring glucose in from the intestinal lumen and dump it into the capillaries. So you might have to diagram this part of it right here. Okay, you might have to diagram this part of it. What powers the transport of glucose from low concentration to high concentration from inside the intestinal lumen to inside the cell? What powers that? Yeah, ultimately ATP does, doesn't it? Whereas, so why is this a symport with sodium being brought into the cell? What does that say about the relative concentration of the sodium in the cell? It's low. Okay. And it's low because it's being pumped out by the what? Sodium ATPase. Where does that sodium go to? For example, if you had an excess sodium in your bloodstream, where would that sodium go to? Your kidneys. Kidneys. So why would a person with congestive heart failure begin to have digestive problems? Why would a person with now, congestive heart failure means what? The blood pressure, I mean, basically the heart is pumping lower and lower. Even the blood pressure is dropping. They just don't have the power. So because the kidney is powered by, in part, the pressure of the blood pressure. So if the blood pressure drops, the kidney can't filter out the sodium as well. Sodium level drops. This has to work harder against the sodium. The concentration here begins to rise a little bit. There's less glucose being brought in. That's the whole idea of that. Any rate, so that's chapter 10, and then 11. There's all these mechanisms. Ding, ding, ding. Let's go back too far. You need to know that table right there, the substrate specificity. What I also needed you to know something about the characteristics of some of these coenzymes. Did I ask you to not ask you know about the human deficiency diseases, I believe? Oh, good grief. Sorry. Reject. What? Oh, which table? This table. Table 11.2. This thing. Matching for that. And I think 11.3 was the human deficiency diseases. Pernicious anemia is the absence of cobalamin or vitamin B12. Pellagra is niacin. Megaloblastic anemia is folic acid. Beriberi is thiamine B2. What? All the ones that have the human disease, deficiency disease. Okay. There's just four of them. What's wrong? Is there a what? Just the four, the human deficiency. Did you want to know all of them? These four right here, which means the vitamin source, what reaction they mediated, and what their coenzyme name is. Believe me, you'll be glad you know it. Okay, and this diagram up here, I'm not going to ask you to regurgitate it, but I know I can ask questions about the relationship between cofactors, metal ions, and coenzymes, co-substrates, and prosthetic groups. Compare and contrast that little chart. Very simple enzymatic catalysis idea. General acid base. You got, there's that RNA ACE. I did not ask you to regurgitate this one, I don't believe. Nope. Not asking you to regurgitate any of the diagrams here. Some of the writing, the covalent catalysis, A, B, C, D, certainly excellent multiple choice question possibility out of that. Let's go on. Whoop. Yeah, the shift base. What is the shift base? What actually is the chemistry? What's the name of the shift base? Imine, and it's a carbon-nitrogen double bond. Many times it substitutes for a carbonyl group. All I'm saying here is this is the catalyzed version, and up here is across the uncatalyzed version, and the catalyzed version includes that shift base, which increases its rate because it gives you a different... No, you do not. No, you do not. Metal ion catalysis. You do not need to memorize any of the diagrams here. Be able to tell me about... the writing portion here, the writing portion. Proximity orientation effects. Because this is universal to all enzymes, I want you to note overhead number 10 in chapter 11 very well, including writing a caption for this table 14.1. Why do the rates increase as you go down the columns? What is happening to the reactants that allow for their increase that is related to proximity and orientation effects? Got to keep going here. Active site, substrate, these are just terms you need to know. Non-reactive TS analogs are potent enzyme inhibitors. You're familiar with that. Active site contains two pieces, catalytic and binding. This is where Chapter 11 homework would be very handy for you to review. Did I tell you what I was going to do on that? Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to assign it so that it's due probably at no earlier than Sunday of next week. But there are many good questions in there that if you use them after you study, if you use them as a review, they would be very helpful, actually, on the test. It gives you a nice double check. I recognize a lot of the questions. So I'm going to open it up tonight. And serine was identified by which inhibitor? What's the chemical, or what's the four-letter designation for the inhibitor? And histidine was found by TPKC, depending on the enzyme name. They are suicide inhibitors, and why are they suicide inhibitors? You do not need to know this diagram, except this is like a show and tell saying that typically the amino acids of the catalytic triad are in fact widely separated on the protein chain, but after folding, they accumulate. What's the purpose of the catalytic triad? Increases the reactivity of serine, and specifically increases the nucleophilicity. Of serine. Increases the nucleophilicity of serine. Okay, now then, this diagram. Was it this diagram? Yes. This diagram, I asked you to be able to do what with? Put it in correct order. Is that correct? Correct. And this is a serine protease. Like I said, I have not had supper yet, so my wife said we're going to have frozen pizza tonight, to which I said, rah. And so when I get home, I'm going to have some pizza that has carbohydrate and fat, but also the carbohydrate the flour contains gluten, which is a protein, and there's some casein in the cheese, so I'll have some protein to eat as well. As soon as it hits my digestive tract, the stomach, which has an acidic trypsin, and then the pancreas will excrete a whole variety of enzymes. Trypsin, chymotrypsin, elastase will digest the rest of the amino acids, the proteins. All of them are serine proteases. All of them have this mechanism. Okay, what's the oxyanion hole for? What's the oxyanion hole for? It stabilizes the transition state. By stabilizing the transition state, it increases the number of transition states that are available at any given instant to go on to the final product. So by the oxyanion hole stabilizes the transition state, increasing its relative concentration, enabling an increased number of products to be formed. What's a zymogen? Right. What factors affect enzyme velocity? Substrate, temperature, pH. Also, there's one more there that is important. I won't be asking a question about it. But if you wouldn't mind writing it down there, heavy metals. Heavy metals affect reaction velocity. Heavy metals poison. So mercury and lead poisoning are affecting enzymes, especially in the brains of growing children. What can you know about enzymes in clinical diagnosis? Are they useful in clinical diagnosis? And how are they useful in clinical diagnosis? That's a good question. I think I'm done. Am I done with 11? 12. Well, my goodness. 12, 12, 12. That's not a bad fertilizer. Equations for This is on overhead number 4 in chapter 12, half-life. Half-life. Both the T half equals 0.693 over K, and also mass final is equal to mass initial divided by 2 to the nth. You are not going to need to know how to derive the Michaelis-Menten formula. You will need to understand what the steady state assumption is. You will need to memorize the Michaelis-Menten equation and use it. You'll see it on the test I gave to you through your email. You'll need to tell me the operational definition of Km. If the substrate concentration S equals the Km, then the V0 equals what? Half Vmax. This is another one that you are supposed to remember till I'm dead. Okay? Which for you should be about less than 30 years. Woohoo! Yes, indeed. So, you guys will just be starting your practice. Just teasing. You'll be well on your way being an established clinician by the time I need you. Okay, so the KCAT, what's a turnover number? And it's not the number of pastries you have in the morning. Okay? Yes? This one? This equation right here. Notice how big and bold it is? That name, and I mean, the name of this, both the name and the equation itself. You need to know its components. What in the world is Vmax? What is it? Maximum velocity for particular enzyme conditions. What's Km? Yeah, what is its actual name? Michaelis-Menten constant or Michaelis constant. Exactly. But then you have the operational definition of it. On this slide? On the previous slide? This one? I don't think. Oh, steady state. Yeah, well, this steady state here, in other words, this B here, and I don't know why I have B. B is a repeat of the previous overhead. The steady state assumption says that the change in the enzyme substrate over time is equal to what? Steady state assumption says the change of enzyme substrate over time is equal to what?
Zero.
Oh, here. Where are we? This right here. Assumption of steady state. So what does this diagram on overhead number 5 have to do with the equation dES all over dt equals zero? Does this diagram support the idea that dES over dt is zero? Does it support that? Yes, it does. And so because it does that, once you set this equal to zero, zero equals this, then you can rearrange this equation and suddenly it becomes a factorable algebraic equation. Boom. And so ultimately, which I'm not going to ask you to do, you get the Michaelis-Menten equation and the idea of what Km value is. Km always has the same units of concentration as the what? Why is that? Because they're being added. If they're being added, they have to have the same units. Okay? Multiplied not, but added, yes. Okay, Vmax divided by ET. Now, what is the ET here? ET. What's ET? Yes, the total number of enzyme active sites. Now then, enzyme active sites, not necessarily just the molecules of the enzyme, but the enzyme can have multiple active sites. And so the ET is the sum, typically in moles, or moles per liter, typically just in moles, of, because the velocity, both the velocity and the molarity can have volume units, and so the volume units cancel out. So typically the Vmax is in moles per minute, and the ET is in total moles, and you get a kcat that's just in blank per time. Okay, how do you find Km and we got to get done with this. How do you find Km and Vmax? What do you use? What is this line called? What is this plot called? Lineweaver-Burk, where you plot 1 over V0 versus 1 over S, and the x-intercept is minus 1 over Km, and the y-intercept is what? 1 over Vmax, and the slope is equal to what? Km over Vmax. This is what we're going to be coming in tomorrow to do pretty early in the morning. I don't know what my son is going to do, but, oh, I know. Never mind. Okay, so, need to do that. We're going to run through this tomorrow. Different kinds of mechanisms. The problem with steady-state kinetics, it can't figure out between most mechanisms, so you have to come up with some things. Here you have the different bisubstrates. You have the ordered, random, and ping pong. You're going to be able to identify that or to talk about it. Maybe some multiple choice questions. Lineweaver-Burk with the various types of inhibition. I asked you to know the model, the mechanism for competitive inhibition, and what the Lineweaver-Burk plot looks like. And how to identify the Ki value from Km apparent. And then you have a different uncompetitive inhibition. What's the difference between competitive, uncompetitive, and mixed competitive? Mixed inhibition, pardon me. And the style or the description of the plot versus the mechanism. Link those two in your minds and never, ever forget. Same way here with mixed or non-competitive. Link the kind of diagram with the kind of mechanism we're undergoing. And so on. Yeah. Okay. The Michaelis-Menten equations may be helpful as well. Certainly, the Lineweaver-Burk equations are going to be helpful. So that means here, what this means here is you need to link the diagram of the plots with the mechanism with the Lineweaver-Burk plot. Notice how I skipped over Michaelis-Menten equation? The Lineweaver-Burk plot. So connect the graph with the mechanism and the Lineweaver-Burk plot. That'll help you very much on equations, answering questions. On this same page, link the diagram, the figure, the graph with the mechanism and with the Lineweaver-Burk plot that produces that and what the alpha and alpha prime are. And finally, of course, same thing here, link the figure with the mechanism with the Lineweaver-Burk plot. And don't forget what alpha means. Alpha is always equal to what? What's alpha always equal to? 1 plus what? I over what? Ki. And then you have some enzymatic effects, and you've got glycogen phosphorylase control. Okay, I hammered this pretty hard on Friday. Is that correct? Yep, there are 4 states of the glycogen phosphorylase enzyme and a total of 3 enzymes in this diagram. The 4 states are not phosphorylated inactive, not phosphorylated active, phosphorylated active, phosphorylated, inactive and inactive. Those 4 states and these 2 enzymes, which are all dealing with that glycogen phosphorylase, and you need to be able to understand that mechanism well enough that if I ask you what if questions, what if the glycogen phosphorylase is normal in every respect except due to a genetic problem, it cannot be phosphorylated? What does that mean as far as the behavior of glycogen in the liver cell? What if I tell you there's a unique viral disease going around in outer Slavonia in which the virus has a kinase that adds phosphates to the inactive form as well. Every one of the normally, it's a normally behaving glycogen phosphorylase. It's just every one of the enzymes in the pool of enzymes that you have gets phosphorylated. How's that going to affect the glycogen stores in your liver? Could that, in fact, have potentially serious problems for your overall metabolism? That's the kind of questions. That is a critical thinking type question, ladies and gentlemen. When you can, when you know the material well enough to answer a what-if question, that's when you really know the material. That's what the MCAT, the DAT, the PCAT, that's what they're all moving to, is what-if. So by giving you a hard time on these questions, I'm in fact preparing you to do very well on the test. Now, we're done with chapter 12. We're going to go over chapter 13 tomorrow. As far as we get with chapter 13, we'll be on the test. But chapter 13...
People smile and tell me I'm the lucky one, and we've just begun. I think I'm gonna have a son. He will be like him and me, as free as a dove, conceived in love. The sun is gonna shine above. And even though we ain't got money, I'm so in love with you, honey. Everything will bring a chain of love. And in the morning when I rise, bring a tear of joy to my eyes and tell me everything's gonna be alright. Love the guy who holds the world in a paper cup. Drink it up. Love him and he'll bring you love. And if you find he helps your mind, better take him home. Yeah, don't you live alone. Try to